Morning Glory and Evening Grace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt from AM 690, The Answer in Honolulu this week. Thank you for listening. David Garth died today. So did Phil Stern. The former made political images. Phil Stern took a lot of them, iconic photographs. And my guest today, Richard Norton Smith, is the biographer of Nelson Rockefeller, On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller. And my guess is that David Garth, who labored for Lindsay, was not one of Rocky's favorite people. But I'll bet you Phil Stern took a few pictures of him. Richard Norton Smith, I want to talk about presidents and big personalities this hour because they're all around us. But I want to start with a little detail you revealed to me.
They seem a lot smaller. I don't know about you. Am I getting older, or
I think you underestimate. You know what your book brought home to me is that there are no last acts until you're dead. And 1960, 1964, and then Rocky's back in 68, and he's back in 74. And I think even if people lose elections, like Romney lost in 2012,
yeah,
and is sitting on the sideline now, or Ted Cruz making his first run, you've got to begin to think of the canvas, not just a corner of it.
Well, and not only that, but of course, eventually, you know, death is only raises the curtain on, in some cases, the longest campaign, you know, and the one where the historians get to decide. Dwight Eisenhower, classic example. You know, the first poll of historians after Ike left office in 1961 ranked him below Chester Arthur.
You know, I also did not know, and I learned from On His Own Terms, that Rockefeller attacked Ike for not being tough enough on defense spending.
You know, one of the, in a life littered with might have beens, the unnecessary animosity that existed between Rockefeller and Eisenhower is something that I find hard to explain, other than sheer arrogance on Rockefeller's part. Rockefeller was, as I said, the ultimate cold warrior. He was also something of a serial alarmist. And he believed passionately that we were not spending enough money to anticipate, not simply to react, but to anticipate to the potential Soviet nuclear threat looking into the 60s. But that's the kind of politician he was. He thought government was too reactive anyway. And Eisenhower, on the other hand, who, let's face it, had unparalleled credentials. He was the only man who, in the wake of Sputnik, could have calmed American hysteria. But beyond that, he was wise enough, and he was conservative enough, fiscally, to say, look, we don't have to be superior to the Russians in every single area of deterrence. We only have to be superior to them in enough. And the fact of the matter is, the Rockefeller brothers' study, the special studies in the late 50s, picked up by John F. Kennedy in 1960, did more to foster the idea of a missile gap, which hurt Richard Nixon, arguably,
very badly,
in 1960, considerably. I mean, in a race that was as close as that was, who knows what one factor might have swung the outcome in a different direction.
Well, one of the great lessons of On His Own Terms is Rockefeller's commitment to civil rights and the party of Lincoln, and also to Hamiltonian infrastructure, road building, and I love this part, moral obligation bonds. John Mitchell plays a role here. I love that. That's how
this is where, again, the historian asks about someone like Rockefeller, not just what is his contemporary impact. They step back and they say, where does he come from? Is he part of a larger political continuum? And yes, he is. You can go all the way back to Alexander Hamilton, and of course you stop at Teddy Roosevelt along the way. It somehow seems appropriate that as a boy, Nelson sat in T.R.'s lap and demanded to know of the former president, who had just come back from an African safari, how he managed to get the giraffes through the Lincoln Tunnel.
But you're going to now embark upon, or you are already embarked upon, a biography of Gerald Ford, who, in my view, embodies both the best and the worst of both wings of the party, in that he is a robust internationalist, but also far more conservative than Rockefeller, and came earlier to see the limits of government than Rockefeller ever did.
And I often say, and you and I may differ on this. I've often thought of Richard Nixon, who was such a protean figure that you stay away from applying any labels, but you can make the case that Richard Nixon, if for only demographic reasons, political shrewdness, is the last New Deal president. I mean, he understood the limits. He understood what the third rail was. He understood how far you could go, and until, in effect, the population, until we were further away from the New Deal consensus. Okay, Gerald Ford, in a lot of ways, is seen popularly as the coda, the caretaker, the extension, almost the afterthought of the Nixon presidency, and there's some of that that's true, but in fact Ford also broke in important ways. I mean, Ford was really the first president to go after economic deregulation in a major way, and it eventually became a bipartisan cause. But indeed, an international cause.
He also, I was talking to Betsy last night, Fetching Mrs. Hewitt, about the book, and saying, I didn't know Happy Rockefeller had a double mastectomy. And she said, oh, yes, the same as Betty Ford. And they saved a lot of lives at this period of time. You spoke with Betty Ford for this book, I believe. And I did not realize she wanted Rockefeller kept on the ticket in 76.
Oh, yeah, she said it was the biggest mistake Jerry ever made. Was dropping Nelson. Well, of course, you could. You know, I'm an agnostic, believe it or not, on this, because I think you can make the case that I think she was making that in November, again, here we go back to the November versus the convention, that Rockefeller remember, they only lost by, 8,000 votes in Ohio and 4,000 in Hawaii, where
right.
You are now.
Right.
And maybe Rockefeller could have made the difference. On the other hand, I think there's an equally cogent argument that had Rockefeller stayed on the ticket, Ford might not have been renominated. He'd become such a polarizing figure, not particularly for anything he had done, He was the face of the Eastern establishment.
And I've got to say, the slapdash, there's a segment in here about the slapdash selection of Bob Dole to be the nominee in 76 to run with Jerry Ford. And I didn't know any of that. And it's almost laughably unthought through.
Well, it testifies to a process that, in a bipartisan way, had never been really systematized. But also, remember, this was a campaign that until 72 hours, 48 hours earlier, really had not nailed down the nomination.
You see, that I had forgotten a lot about. I'm still in college in 76, and I know you're close to Dole. It just never struck me as a very inspired choice, and now I know how it came about. Talk to me, though, Richard, and to everyone out there, and my audience spans the entire political spectrum, but it leans center right to right.
Sure.
This distrust of the Eastern establishment
that
animates everything from denunciations of Karl Rove to the animosity towards Mitt Romney and to John McCain. Well, it all goes back to Nelson Rockefeller.
Well, it actually goes back to Tom Dewey.
See, that I don't know either. Okay.
I mean, it's in the Roosevelt era, the New Deal era, the Republic. Well, actually, it goes back to 1912. Let's face it. Teddy Roosevelt, who in effect broke away, created the Progressive Party. Teddy Roosevelt, who obviously took a vastly more aggressive, pro-statist, if you will, view of government's responsibilities. Teddy Roosevelt, whose stewardship theory of the presidency held that a president was, in fact, legally authorized to do anything the Constitution did not explicitly prohibit. I mean, that is an interpretation of presidential power that most Republicans throughout the 20th century, I think, would take issue with.
But it doesn't explain, the, as you describe it, the howling rage directed at Rockefeller in 64, which, by the way, continues to echo through the party.
Oh, I know. Well, he posthumously, he's a symbol. He's a label. And the one thing, wherever you are on the political spectrum, if you pick up this book and you finish it and you put it down, if nothing else, you may feel ambiguity, you may feel a wealth of conflicting emotions, as I do after 14 years, but you will not make the mistake of thinking this man can be reduced to any one label.
Absolutely. And when you finish On His Own Terms, Richard Norton Smith's brand new book, you're going to just be edified, and you will agree with that. And you'll also learn along the way the politics of Harlem and of upstate New York and of dairy price supports and of everything else you want to know. It makes state legislature interesting. It's impossible to believe, but it's true. Even the Mall of Albany is interesting. I'll be right back, America, with Richard Norton Smith. The book is linked at DewHewitt.com. Minutes after the hour, America's Hugh Hewitt, all of the world grieving with Australia today, and I will be seeing, I saw some Australians earlier today. I'm broadcasting this week from Honolulu, Hawaii, and there are many here, and I've been talking with them, and I'm sure everyone shares that sentiment. My guest today, in my early Christmas present to my audience, is Richard Norton Smith, talking about everything, but specifically about his brand new book on Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller, On His Own Terms. Available everywhere. I've linked it at HughHewitt.com. Richard, a couple hours back, Stephen Hayes of the Weekly Standard tweeted out, instead of mocking President Obama for soft pop culture interviews, GOPers would be wise to imitate him. He's reaching would-be voters they don't. And I added in a response, reading Richard Norton Smith's latest book on Rockefeller makes this abundantly clear, to which a third Twitterer, Sean Hairston, replied, and Rockefeller was beloved by young people who would be watching Colbert today? It's an interesting question, and my answer is, I think so. I think he might have done very well in the new media environment.
You know, one of the things about Rockefeller, which I do not share, he's a real futurist. He really couldn't wait to get... It's one thing, oddly enough, he shared with Ronald Reagan. One of Reagan's great achievements was to rescue American conservatism from, you know, terminal nostalgia. And you always had the sense that Reagan... You know, couldn't wait for tomorrow because he knew it was going to be better than today, and Rockefeller had very much that same outlook. And so I think he would be fascinated, first of all, by the multiplication of ways that people communicate. Certainly politically,
he couldn't tell a joke, though. You said
no. He couldn't. He had a sense of humor, and he would laugh. He knew when you were supposed to laugh. But he wasn't, you know, again, it wasn't part of his repertoire.
Now, I know that authors hate this when I interview them, but I have to read three paragraphs to talk about it. So you'll have to let me do this,
sure.
Even though it's embarrassing. Twice each month, you write on page 190 and 191, GIs disembarking from Queen Mary flowed six blocks east to Rockefeller Center before fanning out into the theater district. Here, the survivors of Anzio and Omaha Beach could enjoy performances of Oklahoma, On the Town, or the Glass Menagerie. For many, Tin Pan Alley took second place to Swing Street under the harsh glare of the noonday sun, an unglamorous block of West 52nd between 5th and 6th Avenue, but by moonlight, a jazz nirvana dispensing the bebop of Dizzy Gillespie and the musical melancholy of Billie Holiday. Drama of a different sort unfolded nightly at the city's 900 nightclubs, in whose smoky precincts, Winchell, Sullivan, Charlie Knickerbocker, and Toots Shore generated enough gossip to sell 10 daily newspapers. 100 tongues and 1,000 traditions jostled for attention on the overcrowded island and its polyglot satellites. As a boy raised in blue-collar Brownsville, wrote Norman Podhoretz, he never thought of himself, quote, as an American. I came from Brooklyn, and in Brooklyn there were no American. There were Jews and Negroes and Italians and Poles and Irishmen, close quote. An impending exodus of Puerto Ricans from their Caribbean island would soon add yet another accent to the dizzying babble of neighborhoods and politics. A quarter of all New Yorkers in 1945 were Jewish, yet they were hardly monolithic. Until the cause of Israel bonded them in those anxious years, Yiddish-speaking merchants on Hester Street had little in common with the German descended assimilationists flocking to Temple Emmanuel L on Park Avenue. 5 years had passed since Father Divine's departure for Philadelphia, but Harlem, he abandoned, remained the undisputed capital of Black America. To be sure, the Harlem Renaissance of the 20s was a distant memory, a cultural sunburst eclipsed by wartime riots and mounting tensions between local residents and absentee landlords. But the neighborhood retained its pulsating vitality, along with such celebrated residents as Ella Fitzgerald and Thurgood Marshall, Bill Bojangles Robinson, the Reverend, soon-to-be Congressman Adam Clayton Paul, James Baldwin, and Langston Hughes. In 1945, Marlon Brando, Tennessee Williams, John Cheever, and Leonard Bernstein were all at the dawn of their New York careers, while Toscanini, Babe Ruth, and Damon Runyon were in the twilight of theirs. On Sunday, inhabitants of Sin City could think positively with Norman Vincent Peale, bask in the enlightened liberalism of Harry Emerson Fosdick at the Rockefeller's Riverside Church, or genuflect to the ruddy, rotund Francis Cardinal Spellman, the American Pope, at St. Patrick's Cathedral. Cyril Connolly, writing in Horizon magazine, paid homage to, quote, what a city ought to be, that is, continuously, insistently, and alive, a place where one can buy a book or meet a friend at any hour of any day or night, where every language is spoken and xenophobia almost unknown, where every person appetite is catered for. If Paris is a setting for romance, concluded Connolly, New York is the perfect city in which to get over one, to get over anything. And that, Richard, is wonderful writing, and it explains Nelson Rockefeller.
It explains that's the world Nelson came back to after having been Assistant Secretary of State and in fact, created the United Nations. he left that world of politics to come back to the world of New York at the very peak of New York's political and cultural influence. And guess what? That parochialism, ironically enough, reflective of that extraordinary diversity, is without a doubt one of the reasons, in my opinion, that he couldn't succeed in the Republican Party.
But it also explains so much. It's why he was for civil rights and why he believed in retail politics.
He's a New Yorker.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and a family. I mean, his grandfather, you know, founded Spelman College in Atlanta. His father was a mainstay of the United Negro College Fund. When Martin Luther King was stabbed in Harlem in 1958, his medical bills were picked up anonymously, quietly, by Nelson Rockefeller. And then, as you mentioned earlier, when the civil rights movement reached its moral apogee in Birmingham in 1963, it was Nelson Rockefeller who, again, anonymously, provided funds to bail out thousands of those taking part in what became known as the Children's Crusade. And remember, it was those children set upon by Bull Connor's dogs and fire hoses, the pictures, first in the newspapers and then on the TV screens, it was those pictures that forced the Kennedy White House to endorse a civil rights bill and really arouse the conscience of white America.
Now, hundreds of pages later, in your book, where you're talking about the 1966 campaign against Arthur Goldberg, which you referenced earlier as being sort of emblematic of the new politics, the new approach, he has to go on, he takes his iron stomach on a walking tour of various neighborhoods and eats everything. And then Arthur Goldberg, not Arthur, who am I talking about? Who's he run against that says, bring me a piece of a Jewish hot dog?
Well, no, yeah, in 70, actually, it's his fourth campaign.
It's his fourth campaign.
Fourth campaign. And he, you know, he's beautifully advanced. I mean, the Rockefeller campaigns never lacked for, you know, first-rate advance work. I mean, great TV, you know, the TV commercials to this day from the 66 campaign are the most intelligent, the most entertaining, the most effective, because he started out 30 points behind. And he actually argued the case that his taxes were well spent. In other words, he convinced the majority of New Yorkers that government was spending their money wisely and that he deserved another 4 years to go on spending it.
And he beat Arthur Goldberg, but that's not the campaign I'm talking about.
Yeah,
we'll come back up.
Frank O'Connor, a real daily double. Frank O'Connor, who was the president of the New York City Council, and a perfectly decent man who was simply run over.
Run over by, in 1970. We come back with Richard Norton Smith. We continue the conversation. And I ask him now, finally, the question I promised. Who's most like Goldwater? Who's most like Reagan? Who's most like Rocky in the field of today? Don't go anywhere except to HughHewitt.com. Pick up a copy on his own terms. It's linked at HughHewitt.com. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. A manhunt is underway in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania at this hour for a man who shot and killed six family members at various locations. It's quite the killing spree. The suspect, Bradley Stone, had a familiar relationship with the victims, but he is terrorizing the region. I'll keep you posted as that happens. I've been very possessive of Richard Norton Smith, my guest, whose brand new book, On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller, is so riveting. But I'll take a call. Mark in Mid-Wilshire. How are you, Mark?
Great, Hugh. Well, first of all, Nelson Rockefeller is the answer to one of my favorite trivia questions, which is, who is Richard Nixon's vice president's vice president?
Yes, indeed.
And I would always ask this question to people when I was down at Occupy LA, when people asked for a cigarette just to throw them off. But one of the reasons I would ask this was because they didn't know that Rockefeller exemplified the 1%, the people that grew up in my era. I grew up in upstate New York in the 70s. He was my governor. So my question is, how did Rockefeller how was he viewed as one of the 1% just because of his association with John D. Rockefeller? And did he get flack for that? Or, you know, how did he deal with that?
Great question, Mark. Richard, you have to summarize the first third of the book here as a result.
No, it's a great question. his father was astonished that people would vote for a Rockefeller for anything. I mean, it was, you know, Nelson broke all the rules, beginning within the family. But, you know, they had spent a lifetime, his father, sort of in some ways redeeming the reputation of the old man, who was for many kind of the quintessential robber baron.
Cleveland's own John D., who gave out dimes to poor kids.
Yeah, yeah. And it was actually is a brilliant case study in PR, how you can, you know, turn around your image. But you've also got to remember, it wasn't just Nelson. As I said earlier, in 1958, he's running against Averell Harriman, who is $75 million in the bank, and frankly, kind of a stiff. I mean, Nelson at least was a friendly, warm, outgoing, charming, you know, he couldn't remember names, but he somehow managed to make Hiya Fella sound like the most personal of endearments. Averell Harriman was a kind of glum, a stuffy figure who couldn't remember names and made Howdy Stranger decidedly off-putting. So New Yorkers had a choice between two millionaires, and they took the one they liked.
And I love the fact that when he raised taxes, he said, my grandfather spent his life giving out dimes. I'm taking them all back at once. And so he was pretty.
But you know what? Business Week that same week hailed him for fiscal responsibility. What was fiscal responsible? He balanced a budget. He was willing to balance it by raising taxes instead of selling bonds. In 1959, that counted for fiscal responsibility.
Now, one of my tweeters asked, though, is this Chris Christie? Are we talking about Chris Christie in this cycle?
No. Look, Rockefeller Republicanism, which, again, underwent over 15 years a lot of changes, but is generally thought of as a combination of fiscal responsibility, certainly a strong private sector, and social conscience, some would say social liberalism, on issues like civil rights, women's rights.
No, he passed the abortion law.
He did. He signed the abortion law, and he vetoed an attempt by the legislature to repeal their own abortion law 2 years later. You're absolutely right. That school of republicanism is, at the very least, in eclipse. I mean, there's no one I can guarantee you there's no one currently thinking of running in 2016 who is going to quote Nelson Rockefeller on anything unless to point out how profoundly unlike him they are.
Well, Richard, an argument about that. Maybe we'll come back after the break. If someone comes out and argues for infrastructure, because he's Pat Brown with an R behind his name, and the state university systems and the nothing gets built in this country anymore. Nothing.
No, listen, I could not agree with you more. And what is, I think, relevant are the governors. You know, we're all talking about senators right now, but the fact is, there's a reason why Americans often, drift toward governors, because they're seen as executives, as administrators, as people who are not necessarily ideologically rigid, but who deal with real-world problems and have to address, you know, real-world solutions.
And get things done. When we come back, whether it's the trash strike or building the New York Thruway, the New York Thruway, Jerry Brown can't get 1 mile of his fast-track train to nowhere built, and Nelson Rockefeller built all these roads. I'll be right back with Richard Norton Smith. Don't go anywhere. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Four minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. My early Christmas present to the audience, this conversation today with Richard Norton Smith, 1-800-520-1234. His brand new book on Nelson Rockefeller and modern American Republican politics on his own terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller, is just wonderful. It's linked at HughHewitt.com. During the break, I received, Richard, a note from my friend Len Frank. I should have sent this to you earlier. Please ask about Diego Rivera's mural that showed Lenin that Nelson had painted over and read the attached poem. Of course, the Battle of Rockefeller Center is detailed in your book.
Yeah, well, and there's some new information. I talked to Christy Todd Whitman, whose grandfather, actually, Mr. Todd, was the man that John D. Rockefeller Jr. had hired to build and manage Rockefeller Center. Let's see, to make this as short as possible, Nelson wanted, in the lobby of the RCA building, Nelson wanted, get this, Picasso, Matisse, and Diego Rivera to each take a wall. And that gives you some idea.
Modest man.
of how he thought, okay? You know, and if it had been left to his devices, he might have gotten away with it. Anyway, in the end, it was down to Rivera. And the story, of course, has always been, you know, that Rivera upset the apple cart by adding the head of Lenin to this 21-foot-long mural, which really wasn't very good. It certainly wasn't very good, Rivera. But it was windy and pompous and political. And anyway, what had happened was he had already been kicked out of the Mexican Communist Party. So he was particularly sensitive to criticism from his fellow Marxists. And he was a painter for millionaires, as far as they were concerned. So anyway, he decided at the last minute that he would show his, you know, communist bona fides by inserting the head of Lenin in the middle of this. The problem was, Lenin was a problem. The real problem, however, was the Rockefellers thought the mural was obscene, because in demonstrating with characteristic Marxist delicacy and subtlety the differences between socialism, heroic socialism, and decadent capitalism, he had chosen to illustrate syphilis quite graphically. And you have to remember, the entrance to the RCA building was across the street from St. Patrick's Cathedral. Anyway, everything that could go wrong went wrong. And Nelson really tried, because he was largely responsible for this. He tried to get Rivera to basically replace Lenin's head. And of course, Rivera, who thrived in controversy, and even then, you can imagine what the New York media were doing with this. So anyway, in the end, Nelson tried to save the mural and have it moved to the Museum of Modern Art, where he was going to charge $1 a head to see it. But unfortunately, Rivera had insisted on painting on plaster instead of canvas, and it could not be saved. So to this day, there are people who go into what is now the GE building, but will always be, to me, the RCA building. They go into the lobby looking for the Diego Rivera mural.
I will inform everyone as well. They should go and Google the New Yorker, E.B. White's painting of May 20th, 1933, which Leonard sent to me, and which is very, very funny.
It's
about
wonderful.
This.
It's, yeah.
So I want to go back to the last segment. When Nelson Rockefeller said there isn't a problem that can't be solved, and he had dirty rivers, he invented the Pure Water Act. He got him pointed. Yeah. And when he wanted a university system because New York had too many private colleges, he built one. When he wanted Albany's square updated.
Brasilia on the Hudson.
Yeah, he did it. But my friend Carl tweets out a fine interview about the political godfather of the architects of an $18 trillion deficit, but a great guy, though. What do you say to that?
Well, no, and you know what? He's right on both counts.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact of the matter is, Nelson Rockefeller, and I have to... You have to distinguish. There is no doubt Nelson Rockefeller left New York State exposed and vulnerable to, for example, the first financial downfall. I mean, in other words, his use of moral obligation bonding, which was, it's astonishing that the banks fell for it in the first place. It basically said we would, but we wouldn't stand behind these bonds. The problem is, again, people conflate New York State's problems, which were real, but which were under control, with New York City's problems, which were absolutely out of control.
And most of his moral obligation bonds were paid off.
They were paid off. Listen, nothing in SUNY, you know, ever defaulted. I mean, he built hundreds of buildings. He built Roosevelt Island and Battery Park City later on, and you go anywhere in New York and you will see physical evidence of projects that were financially successful.
And that's the difference, I think, that a would-be Rockefeller Republican runs into, is that the environmental movement that his brother Lawrence was co-opted into has basically rendered impossible the kind of federalism, Hamiltonian robustness that Nelson personified.
You just put your finger on something important. For conservatives who think of Nelson as the devil incarnate, there is another side, and that is he's a different kind of federalist. Remember, this is a time when states' rights are being defined by George Wallace standing in the schoolhouse door. And Nelson Rockefeller said, the preservation of states' rights depends on the exercise of states' responsibilities. So, in other words, if you've got a polluted Hudson River and New York Harbor, you know, and you're not going to do anything about it, then don't be surprised if at some point the federal government steps in and tries to take latitude away from you. In subject after subject after subject. Now, as I say, by the time he left office, he had come to the painful realization that there were things that no state could do by itself. Environmental issues, for example. Lake Erie famously used to catch on fire.
No, that was Cuyahoga River, but we cleaned it up in Ohio on our own. Richard Norton Smith, don't go anywhere. One more segment. The book, On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller, is linked at HughHewitt.com. Stay with us. 55 minutes after the hour, America, I want to thank my guest, Richard Norton Smith, today. His wonderful and very fun book, On His Own Terms, A Life of Nelson Rockefeller, should be under every Christmas tree for anyone who's a reader. They will laugh out loud. They will thank you repeatedly, and you can give it to pretty much anybody, and they will love this book because it's a look forward to 2016 because of the lessons you learn and a look back over the 20th century. Richard, I want to close on just a personal note. I know you're at work at the Ford biography, but the story you tell at the end about John McConnell, authors have lives, people forget it, and this book wouldn't be here except for John.
Yeah. Well, about 4 years ago, several people who were kind enough to invite me for Thanksgiving dinner, and I had begged off, and anyway, several days went by, and none of them had heard from me. John McConnell was a good friend and a neighbor at the time in Arlington, Virginia. And they got concerned, so he volunteered to come down. And anyway, he knocked on the door, and literally 5 days had gone by since Thanksgiving. I still have very hazy recollections. Turned out I'd had a heart attack, and John insisted I go to the hospital. And lo and behold, they admitted me promptly, and I spent 10 days there, much of it in intensive care, because I had a bunch of blood clots. Anyway, it's a long story. But it's fair to say that if John had not exercised his concern that evening, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation.
Well, he's one of the most revered and liked people in Washington, D.C., and now I even more, because he made this book possible and kept you going. Now, I don't want to be 70 when the Ford biography comes out. I don't want to wait another 14.
Actually, it's a great question. 5 years. I have 5 years, literally, contractually, in every other sense of the word. I have 5 years to finish the book.
So you're moving to Grand Rapids and you're throwing in?
I'm moving to Grand Rapids. And getting back to the real America.
I know you've been there before, but I hope you'll at least venture over to Hillsdale College occasionally to teach a course on the presidency or something like
that. Well, if they ask me, I'd love to.
Richard, congratulations. May it sell many, many books. And a final story. When the family is all accounted for, all of his children ended up divorced, all of them, and one of them dead. And you wonder, was he a good father?
Except
one
the
minute.
The two boys by Happy. Who are both very happily married, very successful fathers, and by all accounts, happy in their lives. So, who knows? He said he made all his mistakes with his first family.
Interesting.
And the last year of his life, he tried to repair some of the damage, and with some success.
Well, it is a bold, it is unsparing in its detail, but it's not vulgar. It's just wonderfully written. Congratulations on his own term. A book that everyone would love having written about them if they were honest and they had had a life like Nelson Rockefeller. Thanks to Adam. Thanks to everyone, Dwayne, and to Daniel, and to everyone here at AM 690 The Answer in Honolulu. I'll be back tomorrow from the Island State. Don't anyone miss a minute of the next Hugh Hewitt Show.